The views and opinions expressed by hosts, invited speakers, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Black Talk Media Project or the Black Talk Radio Network.
Treaty, another installment. Tonight's installment, 10-9-2015. Confronting the Silence, Perspectives and Dialogue on Structural Racism Against People of African Descent Worldwide. Tonight we want to open up with thanks and greetings to Anaji Moued, the brother who hosted our previous show. I want to give him props in a very interesting dialogue he had this past week on race treaty. This week, we want to speak to something that's going on that the U.S., the Black Americans, African Americans have not really embraced in understanding that there was a declaration at the U.N. for a decade for those of African descent worldwide. And I'll read the preamble of that to start this show. The UN General Assembly proclaimed 2015 through 2024 as the International Decade for People of African Descent, with a theme, People of African Descent, Recognition, Justice, and Development. At the center of this initiative is the promotion and protection of all human rights of people of African descent, the improvement of their well-being, and the recognition of their culture, history, contribution to societies. The General Assembly also endorses a program of activities which is to be implemented by all relevant actors, including the United Nations, member states, regional, sub-regional organizations, civil society actors, including organizations of people of African descent. The decade and its programs of activities are an implementation of the decade to further advance the anti-racism agenda as defined inter alia in the Durban Declaration and the Program of Action, its outcome document, political declaration, and the International Convention for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. This sums up the motivation for this show, Race Treaty, which is another term for CERD, the Convention for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. And so part of the goals in giving some background to this show and Race Treaty was to see the integration of CERD and hold it up as international law, which the U.S. has signed treaty along with 192 other countries, as it's framed within the white supremacist analysis. We have a 10-year opportunity to organize. Actually, we have a premise to organize globally among the descendants of Africans worldwide suffering the same dynamics of white supremacy. How it's played out in its nuances still affects all peoples of color, specifically those of African descent. This decade gives an opportunity for a global conversation about the issues of white supremacy and racism. As I know personally, right now, Europe is fast organizing around this decade. And they are interjecting the issues concerning CERD the law, the human rights law that should be our precedent reference. U.S., we're behind, in my opinion. But what I would like to outline is some hope in this upcoming conference where the Black Lives Initiative, Amnesty International, and various other notables that will be rendering a Latin America and Caribbean perspective, an international perspective, a U.S. perspective, and a European perspective on the dynamics of institutional racism. There's been a lot of activity around the issues of racism these last few years, stemming previous to Black Lives Matter, and there's been a lack of a framework of human rights violations, as it were. We lament the killings. We understand that there's no federal requirement to render the data from these killings and the police killings, I should say, specifically. And these dynamics are being played out around the world. What we have been hoping with Black Lives Matter as a movement and now an initiative is that it would reach the international stage and expand its lens from civil rights to human rights. In fact, Black Lives Matter was quick to reject the so-called civil rights leaders coming in to co-opt and so-called lead a grassroots response, a people's response to the oppression that we're undergoing daily in this country. So the human rights lens, the seed was planted, I believe, with Black Lives Matter as a movement, especially when it went international in support of Palestine, understanding the worldwide dynamics of the system of white supremacy. So to advertise what's really going on, there will be at the UN Secretariat Conference Building in New York Tuesday, the 3rd of November, a gathering of notables, and I'll speak out some on some of them. The keynote will be Harry Belafonte, Danny Glover, Forrest Whitaker. Opening remarks will be Tamiri Rice's mother, John Crawford's father, Miss Africa Gordon, cousin of Emmett Till. There will be panelists, again, from the various areas of the Western Hemisphere and Europe, the international perspective. And the background and premise, and I'm going to share this because this is the foundation of this show today, the background of this international gathering to deal with institutional racism speaks to this. Quote, although some progress has been made at the national, regional, and international levels to prevent and eliminate racism against people of African descent, important challenges remain worldwide that reveal deep-rooted structural racism and racial discrimination against people of African descent. Indeed, structural discrimination is still a reality in the daily life of people, number of people of African descent. They continue to experience its pervasive and disproportionate effects as a result of the historical injustices and grave human rights violations that have suffered, including, among others, slavery and racial segregation. Whether as descendants of the victims of the transatlantic slave trade or as more recent migrants, people of African descent throughout the world are among the poorest of the poor. They usually face racial discrimination in the access to the fundamental rights, including quality and high education, as well as employment. This is the background preamble to this gathering. What's important to note for me and what I'd like to speak on is that when we use the term disproportionate effects, disparate outcomes, these are the trigger points of violation in international law, specifically CERD. And yet, here is a contradiction. There is no data in all areas of people activity that has been aggregated to show the algorithms, if you will, of white supremacy, but to also trigger the a clear picture on the violations of human rights law that the U.S. engages in daily, structurally, systemically, institutionally, much less the interpersonal prejudice, racial prejudice that's played out by the power system of white supremacy on an individual basis. So here's an opportunity to actually deal with the issue of disparate outcome and proportionality and demand that we, the UN or the people, actually work towards building a information and data portal that will aggregate this information and render a clear statistical data-driven storyline to our history and the continued violations of human rights law concerning racism by the United States. We have, you know, new sciences such as implicit bias being utilized to maybe justify, if not explain, the systemic process of white supremacy without the personal guilt or responsibility in the participants that function, both black and white, by the way. To be clear, racism and white supremacy. On the flip side, you have proxy racism, which is a total cultural world view to uphold the system that oppresses us. So, getting back to this gathering, it's interesting again that now the world picture is coming together. We have Black Lives Matter representative Alicia Garza will be speaking. That's very, very important, as well as the chair from the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance speaking for the European perspective. Very, very important. We're coming to a point where I think we're understanding by the recent Loretta Lynch, Lynch's response stating that she was more concerned with police relationships in the community than she was the data being required by for all fatalities or shooting incidents by police. That there's no requirement for that. If there were requirements and that data was revealed, it would trigger a human rights violation in accordance with CERD law, whereas the U.S. would then be compelled by law to come within compliance. That trigger is really not there when we have kind of haphazard statistics that we're aggregating and actually depending on European newspapers as relates to killings by police to get the picture by the numbers. That's something I think the UN subcommittee is may entertain, and certainly the Committee for the Decade of Those of African Descent, because there's a storyline in all of these countries of those of African descent, including Israel especially, how the African migrants are treated. So it's time that the story be told in the picture of algorithms and data, not just reports and not just complaints and not just documentation in specific areas. Excuse me. All right, brother. I'm glad you're back, Scotty. I'd like you to pipe in on this because, you know, I've been working in my own field in referencing the UN going back a few years with Fight Racism Global, where we had a demo at the UN concerning CERD, concerning that here's a law that's been signed and, you know, signed and ratified, and yet is really not used as a reference point to our ills going on in our society. There's individuals now prepared to go to the UN and bring a case against the U.S., complaints against the U.S. in specific areas, one most recently the state-sponsored terrorism by the U.S., but there's a myriad of ills that are manifested in all areas of people activity, education, health, law enforcement. the disparate outcomes and the data, I mean, we read headlines, but we don't get the hard data in a collective manner, aggregated manner, to really paint a picture of a system built to oppress. And I'm talking the laws, I'm talking the culture of appropriation, I'm talking even the groundswell movement of the threatened middle class whites who now are entering into the poverty class, rebelling, utilizing the term occupy. Not unoccupy, deoccupy, but occupy, stemming from a colonial vocabulary, colonialist vocabulary. And we have an opportunity with a decade in the U.S. Really, we need to really catch on that there's a 10-year decade focus on us, and we need to focus on us in that process as well. Still, there's that battle with a Black Lives Matter and the pushback against the use of that term, even though it's clear understanding that anti-black racism actually is the fulcrum of racial discrimination. It is the core of racial discrimination built up. And so to eradicate or dismantle or address the issues of structural racism, one must delve in that system to its core. And so the Black Lives Matter as a movement, now becoming an initiative, manifesting in policies and dabbling in the public arena of politics, as it very important that all of this inward national lament and issues that we address now be brought to an international arena. And that speaks to something else that's quite important and historical. I'm glad we have an opportunity to speak to it, and that would be the Justice or Else, the Million Man March anniversary coming up this weekend. And it's not a slogan, Justice or Else. It's an understanding how we as a people have been positioned to request data, request hearings, request adjustment, request reforms, request justice, knowing racism cannot render justice. So with the Justice or Else, the or else element, as I stand by and observe and pray and hope, is that a plebiscite, a identity formation will come out of that gathering, which I must also commend the organizing efforts for inclusion of men of color from the First Nations and Latin or Hispanic or Nikon Talaka is the proper term, inclusion in this march. And it's not just a protest or a lamentation, and I'm really looking forward to it being historical as I see a lot of elements converging to the international arena, and that we're seeing unity that the Occupy movement really couldn't provide, and that it wouldn't embrace racial justice in its platform.
I have a question.
Yes, brother.
I mean, you actually hosted a program where, you know, we had American Indian activists who had actually had planned on going to the Justice or Else rally and whatnot. But in terms of the broader black community, and I can only go by off of my interactions personally with people and what I read and what I see. So this isn't like to say that what I'm about to say applies to everyone. But there are, I would say, a high percentage of black people that I talk to or I interact with, man, that does not see a multicultural struggle. They don't identify with other non-white people. They say let those other non-white people fight their own battles, and they're not looking to work with anybody else against the system of racism and white supremacy. What have you observed, and what are your thoughts on that? Is this could possibly there be wider movement in collaboration with other non-white people? Go ahead,
Scotty. I feel there must be. First of all, when you study the history of the Brotherhood, and a lot of so-called African Americans and Black Americans do have Native DNA, no matter what the European records indicate or lack thereof, you, as a social change and working against oppression, must join in with the others that have been oppressed. And here is a group that endured genocide in the land that we stand, and to not include and reach out to their issues concerning the same oppressive power system, to me works against us, as not to say that we should be should not be focused on African Americans, as that's how we identify. But I have an issue with that, in that it has to be multiracial, because the system affects everybody in different ways, obviously. But to be say it's limited to just those of African descent, I think those of African descent should be the
vanguard,
the organizers, the forefront of it at this point, positioned in understanding the power dynamics against white supremacy, because a lot of people of Native descent have bridged over to a white monoculture value system and identify more as white than they do with people of color. And I exclude those who experience the high dynamics of killings by police and the poverty on the reservations.
They suffer from disproportionate incarceration rates as well.
Across the board. And so,
yeah, that's why I'm saying all of these struggles are similar. And it's the same oppressor.
Yes, brother, because the oppressor is the same oppressor. It's white supremacy. And it plays out systemically in various areas. And it's worldwide. It's global. It is a system, a power dynamic. And, you know, I've talked to an IT architect. The brother's a Six Sigma black belt. Worked for GE. Is a brilliant mind. And I discussed, like, okay, here's all these areas of people activity where white supremacy or racism manifests daily. And there's reports out. There's and documentation and headlines and research and studies. Why can't all of that information be extracted not only on federal, state, and local, but through the corporate world, through civil society, and individual complaints? Why can't all of that information be pooled into one place and then broken down from there? And you would actually see almost like a living system of white supremacy globally. Now, we can visualize it in the abstract, and we can cherry pick reports on statistics in one area or another, but the overall picture is what we need when, as the sister that was on our show last week is speaking to, bringing up a reconciliation commission similar to South Africa to address the ills of the history. Well, if we're not going in there with the full data, we're going in there then asking for something, it seems to me. What I would like to see is all of this information delivered in that reconciliation commission as a prelude to here is the tab for reparations. Because, you know, and we have to institution build. I mean, that's part of the reparations. We're cut out, control no industry, run no institutions, you know. And so the self-determination is cut off. That's like the root of the growing of us as a people is the way I see it. And so, yeah, there has to be a reach out. And I have to give big props to Brother David, too, who's a First Nation brother that crossed the line and found that indigenous commonality with the Latino population as well, that are indeed indigenous as well. And then he reached out, understanding that there's the Black Indian dynamic. I mean, the whole southeast quadrant of the U.S., if you look at any historical pictures, those is black folks, you know, and how that became a European look, you know, and now they've got the big thing, what is it called, the Cowboy and Indian Coalition. No, I noted that they didn't say Indian first. They said the Cowboy and Indian Coalition dealing with the environmental. So there's like an appropriation of causes by this European system of white supremacy. There's an appropriation of culture. It's almost parasitical in its form and how it feeds off of us, and it's produced a proxy racist, a monocultured individual seeking the 401k dream and the all-American dream, and you know, I found that money don't buy you happiness. It doesn't buy you a quality of life, and it doesn't buy you health, realistically. So how do we get to the core of white supremacy? So we got an international group confronting the silence. To me, the silence is in the data. The silence is in the data.
What do you mean?
Or the lack of data that's collected.
Oh, okay, I got you. I got you. You just had U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch said she disagrees with Eric Holder about mandating a federal mandate, which will require legislation, because the current legislation that was passed in the 90s is only a recommendation that police keep statistics on the extrajudicial killings. And we just heard her say, well, she doesn't support mandating to them.
Well, she's positioned as a legal defense for the United States government also, in understanding that with that data is the trigger for human rights violations. So they're going to be culpable in their own end in revealing this data to the world as required by the law and the treaty they signed. So the negligent part and the weakness of this international law is that the U.S. doesn't require internally, nationally, the data that they've signed on to submit to the international body concerning racism, and they don't submit that, and they don't require it. And so, you know, I understand Mrs. Lynch saying, well, if I required it, I'm setting off the alarm for a human rights violation. So I'm saying, why do we lament and seek this information through the U.S. government? It doesn't, you know, when we can maybe petition a different forum to extract that information over the internet.
Well, there are people already collecting that data. But I feel that the data that is being collected on the extrajudicial killings is possibly underestimated, because it requires on media reports in order to record the data, like killedbypolice.net, which is a citizen-run database. But now you got The Guardian, I believe, and there's another one, which is media. Corporate media keeping records, and you even had FBI Director James Comey recently lament the fact that the media is keeping better records than they are. So,
well, this also lends clarity to the U.S. government's lack of motivation to reveal this information, much less collect it. And so, again, I don't think it should be incumbent upon the U.S. I think that the U.N., the subcommittee on the system that was on last week, I think they need to take that on and create a CERN violations portal and pull all this information and do it globally, even, you know, because the U.S. plays games. The law is a shell game, man. I mean, we still doing this thing for voters' rights, and Alabama pumped it up on steroids by just saying flat out, we just going to eliminate the DMV offices in the Black Hood, period.
Wow.
You know?
Wow. In North Carolina, they also, they got a case before the Supreme Court. But listen, before we go to break, if you have a question, a comment of our guest, of our host, Brother Robin, give us a call at 641-715-3660. The participant code is 549032#. And for those already dialed in, just hit *6 and 1, and I will bring you on air, and you can pose your question or comment to our host, the Race Treaty, Brother Robin Benton.
This is Brother Elliot, host of Time for an Awakening, and you're listening to Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennium.
Yes. Welcome back to Race Treaty. A very important update in reference to the international movement to address the issue of racism. Now the testimonies from across the world are coming into one arena, one place to hear the voices, and an opportunity for the world diaspora of African descent to organize. We have an umbrella, an actual apparatus, a self-determination apparatus, if we can take the reins of it and address these human rights and reframe the laws of white supremacy in which we live under. I have great hopes. Even when the Black Lives Matter, they had a law for Black Lives Matter gathering within the civil rights legal realm to address these issues. We see the NAACP starting to step up to address these issues. And I don't get caught up in the semantics of the Million Man March, Black Lives Matter. These are movements. That's real energy. That's something that's alive by the common mind as being focused on the same thing, trying to address the same issues. That's critical mass. That's where I feel like the global opportunity to address our issues in common is through the UN. And that's not to say that the UN is the answer. I really feel like it's the last area in which we can really voice our issues, even though the issue of enforcement is still lacking under white supremacy, because with power is that oppressive element of violence stemming from the state as well, which also speaks to the grassroots in the political realm of the U.S. Legal frame, and that would be city council, human rights commissions, enacting international law into local municipal law. I've again repeat, you know, the reference to what happened in Chicago behind the Holman Square incident of torture, where the city council found the quick fix and just extracted international human rights law violations of torture law, applied it as law, and rendered a award for damages for torture. Same thing applies to the issue of racism, and the same thing applies to the issue of how children are treated under human rights law. And another thing to share is that the United States is the only country in the world that has not signed on to the treaty to protect children's rights. And many of the aggregated data that Reverend Buford has compiled to go before the world courts on extrajudicial killings are against minors, which is in violation, again, of another element, a component of human rights law and treaties. And you would like to think that the U.S. is this benevolent, you know, country. We know better, obviously. But to be the only country in the world not to even sign a treaty to protect children's rights speaks to the condition and the treatment of children in this country. The fact that one is child poverty in the U.S. is among the worst in the developed world. And why is that? With the abundance that is here, there's a lot of children are homeless. These are violations of human rights law. And so until we look to the international arena, we're not going to find answers in the maze of civil rights and the legal system of white supremacy. It ain't made for us.
Of course, you know, I agree with that. Human rights is the way to go, as Malcolm said, and not civil rights, all right? Because civil rights can be legislated away, okay?
Correct.
And so, you know, we have human rights that's endowed upon us as sovereign beings. But Here is the thing, though. Okay, we have these international human rights laws and these treaties that the United States has signed, and, you know, I'm not sure if they ratified everything. You could probably speak more to that. But here is the thing, though. If there is no way to punish the United States for its violations, then, I mean, where's the deterrent? Obviously, there is no deterrent. They violate human rights all day long and have been doing so, you know, ever since they ever signed on to those treaties. So there is no way to sanction the United States if the rest of the world globally is not going to boycott the United States or whatnot, then I really don't see how any relief is going to come. Just for example, you know, Malcolm X was going around to Africa as well as some of the Arab countries, but primarily he went to Africa and he was trying to get them to see that their struggle is our struggle and our struggle is their struggle. All right. And he was just trying to get them to, you know, stand up for Africans trapped inside of America behind these enemy lines at the UN level. But today I read an article, you know, and now it's like, you know, nations in Africa, and I understand they still suffering under colonialism. The United States has them hooked on, you know, that aid that they give them in the forms of money and other incentives for them to do whatever the United States wants them to do. But I was reading an article today about the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and this other group that's separate from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, but still pretty much does the same thing, except for they're trying to bridge established trade in Africa between U.S. corporations and African corporations or businesses, and strengthen trade as they watch how the Chinese are all over Africa and establishing trade. And then I was thinking, you know, to myself, is that, you know, see them brothers and sisters over there that's doing business or you know, sitting down at the table with these people, are they, you know, having preconditions that, yes, we'll do business with you, we'll do trade with you, but, you know, you have to start enforcing you know, the human rights treaties and whatnot. So I don't mean to be a pessimist, Brother Robin, but I really don't see anybody.
Can I speak to the underlay for the overplay on what you just spoke on? Now, this Trans-Pacific Partnership, we have to understand the dynamics of what a corporation is. A corporation has these human rights, correct? Well, the corporations are now about to enter into foreign tribunals and demand taxpayer compensation for lawsuits that they apply as a corporation against countries, and the taxpayers have to pay. So they've got an enforcement back in utilizing human rights in Human Rights International Law tribunals, where we should be. Speaking of the strategy and referencing to Africa, the corporations that are from the U.S. that violate in other countries, if we were coordinated there, we could enter into the international tribunals in Africa. We can enter into them in Europe. We can actually follow the globalist tentacles and have a voice as people of African descent concerning racism in those tribunals. But right now, the corporations are already, I've been following this, by the way, for a few months now, when I read that corporations, not only that they have human rights, but they're about to start
exercising them in international
courts.
How can a non-human have human rights, man?
Well, that's the wickedness of white supremacy, okay? So how do you so-called free slaves and have maybe four subsequent court actions thereafter for 50 years, and at the same exact time you conjure to an esoteric means a non-living entity and afford it the rights of a human personhood? And the only mandate that a corporation has is for profit. They have no political, they have no, excuse me, ethical or moral element to their identity. In other words, they will poison you, and until you sue them, they will pay in an installed payment plan, write it off on taxes, and no individual goes to prison. So in the meantime, they already had the loophole set up on the Emancipation Proclamation, on the 14th Amendment, rather, because the 13th Amendment superseded it with the clause, the exception clause. So that's the diabolical element to when we talk about governments. We have to also talk about corporations and what roles they play interfaced under fascism. Because U.S. is protects business interests of U.S. corporations. U.S. corporations place the politicians in the office with their own prefab legislation that benefits them. Now they're making a ninja move into international tribunals where they can now start suing countries that they just gave money or that have just borrowed money from the world courts. So they got an underlay for the overplay. And so that's kind of one was the bottom line with Occupy was the corporations, but they didn't understand that like Wall Street is built on 20,000 African bones, a violation right there. And the identity of corporation in terms of personhood was a conjured act at the same time as this so-called act to free the slaves. So, it's diabolical. White supremacy is diabolical in the way it's formulated. So, at any rate, man, I just feel that, the UN is the last vestige, and if we can get there with our own voice, then that would be a good thing.
Yeah, I agree, Brother Robin. It would be a good thing. But also, we would then be able to tell ourselves and tell the world that we tried everything, all right?
Right.
We tried everything to do it peacefully.
Man, before it goes all out. You're right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, maybe I'm being compromising, but I understand the end game as well, even in metaphysical terms, but this system we live under is unrighteous, man. It's very unrighteous. And I think that the UN is the last arena that we can enter into. One moment, please.
I'm saying we should, of course, present those cases to the UN and whatnot, but I'm just a pessimist.
You're a realist in part because that's the history. But what I'm saying is there's a window of opportunity with this decade. It is significant.
Right.
It is an organizing apparatus already in place.
Right.
But we have to control the narrative. We have to, build it up, big it up, make it part of the mantra. The human rights lens is the mantra of Black Lives Matter and NAACP. They need to bridge over out of the puddle of civil rights and embrace the international arena direct their efforts to assist the people, if that's the case. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I do agree, that's the last resort. You go there, you do what you can, and if they still don't hear us, then you can say to the world and to yourself with good conscience, well, I tried to do everything peacefully, but these people don't want peace, so, by any means necessary, we're going to have to get free.
Well, right. Right. And that's the next thing, man. Is that should be the premise? As you said, you've been talking to people, and they said we just need to worry about ourselves. Well, reality is we better suited to know that we have brethren when a calamity comes about.
Exactly.
I kind of like follow the right and understand they've got manuals out like relocation strategy where they identify people of color coming out of the cities in the event of an economic collapse and the food doesn't enter in by the containers, within 2 weeks, people will be trying to get out of the cities. They outline the paths, where they might be coming, and they're prepared. You know, this is not like this isn't a reaction. This is a planned end, you know. And so there's a lot of scenarios being played out. And this is why I feel like, you know, our conversation should be in the world courts amongst the world's people. Because in reality, when we go to the UN, we're seeing ourselves by a vast majority, most
right,
manipulated by the power system, which is corrupt, has no moral foundation, no more than the corporations themselves have a moral foundation. It's about profit. It's about profit, and it's about white supremacy. And so, yeah, well, there also is supposed to be these rumblings of the UN becoming a police force also to implement and enforce human rights laws or international law. I don't know how far that will get.
Well, all we need do is look at Africa, where they have been implicated in scandals of abusing children sexually.
Right. That whole white savior complex is embedded with pedophiles and otherwise exploiters as well. And, you know, slavery is around. It's a lot of people are enslaved across the world in various forms. And so that's mm-hmm. acceptable to the capitalist system as well, it seems.
Right, right. Especially in, I'm speaking on a place that I've been, but Saudi Arabia. They definitely practice slavery. They tricked them people into coming over there. And thinking they gonna get good paying jobs and whatnot, and they end up being enslaved and abused.
Exactly.
I could think of some other Arab countries that's happening in as well. The United Arab Emirates, and I've read about some similar things going on there, and yeah. So.
Well, you know, the technology that they use using their power, even in the international arena, like recently the U.S. backed Saudi Arabia as like one of their representatives heading the Human Rights Council.
Yes, yes, I read about
you know,
that.
So that kind of joke when we know that Saudi Arabia is a puppet of the U.S. In fact, you know, Dick Cheney ran a trick game on them many years ago, But you know, even when the 9/11 thing, I don't even understand the logic of all the things that transpired after 9/11. If they identified these so-called terrorists coming from Saudi Arabia, we didn't do shit. We didn't go. As a matter of fact, the only airplane in the U.S. airspace was a plane with the Bin Laden family leaving the country. So I mean, you know, people don't want to. They it's like people live under cognitive dissonance. On top of the embedding of these false narratives out of the mainstream media. So we really need like humanrights.tv, antiracism.tv. We need 24/7 deprogramming channels to counter the narrative of falsehood coming out of white supremacy.
You
That's
know,
one of the problems
I
we have right now.
And I would co-sign on to what you just said. And I would say also that I think that psychologically, people, they would destroy people's world because they need this sense of stability. They need to believe that they live in the best place on the planet and, you know, that...
that they are default
yeah.
for all elements of reality. They are the default from their Christianity to education, philosophy, everything. They are the default. And that's a falsehood in respect to reality when 9 out of 10 people on Earth are of color, first of all. You know, and if you build a identity based on a complexion, whereas in the U.S. and South Africa are the only two countries, by the way, in the world that identify you in your birth certificate by a race designation that they actually created. Well, I don't even know who's behind the census and how that works. I mean, I've tried to understand it's like a like behind the veil of this racial identity thing. And that really also, speaking of justice or else, gives promise to the potential of self-determination by the number of black or people of color gathered together in D.C. this weekend. Monumental energy, that's a real thing. And where it's directed and what commonality base besides the oppression on the affirmative, what self-determination steps can be made coming out of that, I like to know, not just, you know, taking up a collection of a dollar from a million people. It's really, you know, about the identity, so we can get to that last vestige of law, which is the world courts under human rights law. And, you know, it's ironic because we have 700 countries where the majority are non-white cities in this country. Mm-hmm. That we should, if we are dealing in self-determination, be able to institute whatever we will. If we weren't using the oppressor's apparatus to oppress ourselves or our own brethren, no, a failed apparatus, white supremacy, those who function in it to uphold it are proxy racists. That needs more case study, Scotty, you know.
I'm trying to study it all the time, man. I'm actually working on a book that focuses on proxy racism, how to end white supremacy.
Well,
yes,
sir.
Yeah, that's just a working title, but
the neurosis goes deep. It really does, because it's based on this monoculture, which is basically a proxy to the white default. Mm-hmm. You know, and so how these layers are unfolded, you know, unfolding, how we self-determine our own destiny, because, like, you know, right now, under the stewardship of the white patriarchal reality, everything's messed up, you know, under the corporations, from food, air, water, everything. And while everyone's lamenting human rights and starting to wake up on it, that enforcement issue is an issue. But it's a legal mechanism that can be imposed and enforced and enacted on a local municipal basis. And we have 700 cities that should be models
for
self-determination.
Like Jackson, like Jackson. Where was
Brother
Chokeway?
Seattle's incorporated some, Minneapolis, Austin. But I have to say, man, like, okay, so we win the argument. There is no argument on reparations. What infrastructure do we have to receive the compensation in the way of institutional building if we don't control any of our own institutions?
You know, I was just talking about
it. So there's some steps, I think, that have to be done in controlling our own local politics.
Well, you may disagree with me. If you do, that's fine, you know. But I was speaking on the reparations movement today because I'm part of I was added to a reparations group on Facebook, and, you know, I know people who are active in the reparations movement. I have reported on some of the news coming out of the movement, like recently Jamaica telling, you know, the UK, David Cameron,
we'll build you a prison and lock you up, but we ain't want to talk about no reparations.
Right. And so. My thing, though, I was saying in terms of the reparations movement versus the new abolitionist movement, that it just seems illogical for me to be trying to gain monetary compensation for something that's still ongoing. You know, it's like you saying, most people in the reparations movement, they use that language as to where slavery is thought of in past tense. And not present.
Know, you should know that Anaji was one of the co-founders of Encobra.
Okay.
And so he's got some background in his element of reparations is restoration and healing. Mm-hmm. And that may come by having institutions that we control to address our own issues, mm-hmm. you know, and coming out of the days of Willie Lynch, 400 mm-hmm. years, you know.
But let me put it to you this way. Like, somebody said to me earlier, and I thought what they said was very succinct, and it hit it on point. They said, if you think about it, the reparations folks would be much better served by understanding that slavery is still ongoing, has never ceased, and is still racking up an enormous bill due to the folks it is exploiting directly and indirectly.
Well, brother, I see reparations coming out of the bottleneck of addressing the issue of white supremacy and setting up another mechanism of enforcement to dismantle it. That's what I speak about coming up with this data. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, if you could see it on a computer screen, it would be like a live organism of seeing all that data. I mean, you could see that in Twitter when they do Twitter accounts on racism, they can see feeds of up and down the graph of racist comments after headlines and reactions thereof.
Right, right.
You know, so those elements are there, alive in people's mind and as an energy that I think we need to harness to get a macro understanding of it, and then deal with reparations. And that still, again, can come in the form of our own institutions that we control.
Hey, I'll take Georgia, Florida, South Carolina, North Carolina. That's what I'll take is reparations.
Yeah, you don't want Mississippi?
Mississippi, yeah, they got
Jackson's cold. There, so we got to go, you know.
Yeah.
That's inclusive. And, you know, they can go up to Oregon, right?
Iowa.
All of that. They're already there, man. They got bunker cities and shit set up. All these feds are retiring and moving to Iowa. And then you got Nassau and Wyoming. You know, they got a, you know, strategic relocation. Y'all look that manual up and see how these people are really thinking and planning. This is like beyond preppers. This is like, you know, they consider it security analysis, you know, for the maintenance of white supremacy.
White supremacist retirement community, huh?
Exactly. Exactly. So hopefully next week we have a guest scheduled, Michael McEachrain, who is working with MPAD on the Decade Active in Sweden as we span off of the Fight Racism Global. They've been organizing across Europe, and they're also organizing in the Spanish-speaking countries where we have isolate pockets of those of African descent that aren't talked about. And then, you know, Brazil being the largest body of those of African descent in the diaspora, mm-hmm. 10 times more than there are African Americans in this country. Mm-hmm. But we can't get to them because of the Portuguese English language issue, you know. And so those things are all being dealt with this gentleman, Michael McEachrain, who should be our guest next week from Sweden. Thank you. Join us next week. Thank you, Scotty.
You're welcome.
Peace.
Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me.